This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
Hi everyone, this is Chris Grasso with the Indie Spirituals Podcast on the Be Here Now Network, and my guest today is Spring Washam. Spring, thank you so much for taking the time to be with me.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm excited to chat with you.
As am I. I've been looking forward to this for quite a while. So before we jump into the conversation, I'm going to read your bio for any of the listeners not familiar with your work, and then we're just going to jump right into things. So Spring Washam is a well-known meditation teacher based in California, founding teacher of the East Bay Meditation Center, and founder of Lotus Vine Journeys. Spring is a pioneer in bringing mindfulness-based healing practices to diverse communities. She's author of A Fierce Heart, Finding Strength, Courage, and Wisdom in Any Moment, recently released by Hay House. Her new book provides valuable and inspiring information on moving forward through challenges and taking the wise road, as she would say. You can find more about Spring at Spring Washam, that's WASSAM.com/book, or lotusvinejourneys.com. If you are listening to this on the Be Here Now website, please just scroll down. The links for Spring's information is there. Her book is there. Anything you could need is all just a click away. So again, Spring, thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation with me.
Yeah, happy to be here with you.
Appreciate it. So your book, A Fierce Heart, as mentioned, was recently published with Hay House and features a really nice foreword by friend Jack Kornfield, who is a incredible teacher, and immediately I was touched by the very lovely endorsement that Alice Walker had written for you, that's on the cover of the book. And you know, it's just really what a tremendous story and read and sharing of the heart, and it's filled with practices and so much wisdom and insight. We could go a million different directions, but the one way I do typically like to start my conversations is to give the audience a little bit of background about the guest. So I know that you grew up on the West Coast in California, and you grew up in an apartment complex in Bellflower, which was a low income neighborhood, kind of right in between Compton and Long Beach. Two areas I'm personally familiar with through a lot of the music I grew up listening to as a teenager, but you were there living in that. So I was wondering if you could walk us through that experience, because, a lot of my listeners know that area and know, you know, what it was like, or at least have read stories or heard the songs. But I'm guessing some of the other Be Here Now crowd might not be so familiar with that. So if you don't mind sharing a little bit what it was like growing up in that environment, and ultimately what led you from that to becoming a mindfulness meditation teacher?
Yeah, so people do, when they think of East Long Beach, I know it could be a generational thing, but they might think of hip hop and rappers and yeah. Snoop Dogg and right. Tupac Shakur and all that.
Yeah.
I think for me, as I grew up, it was It was something that was really challenging in a lot of ways because I was so sensitive and I was already noticing the suffering around me. You know, the violence and addiction and broken families and so many emotional people around me. So I was very observant, like, what is happening? What is causing this? And of course, you know, when you grow up in areas like that, you get hurt by the violence around you. You know, and as a teenager, and I was in South Central Los Angeles, just right in the height of all of the gang violence. And it's really amazing. Things have calmed down a lot. But it was like right in the midst of all that. And so, of course, you know, you learn from that and you learn through the traumas of experiencing that. So in some way, I think that fueled my interest and also motivated me to try to understand, you know, why is this happening? Why are people so hurt? Why are people so traumatized? Why are they doing these things to each other and then things are done to them? So in some way, it was kind of the perfect opportunity, even though I wouldn't wish it on people. So, I mean, I wish sometimes I, you know, wish things would have been easier, but life isn't a fairy tale, you know, for many of us. So I learned a lot from that. And that kind of, you know, I write about my first chapter in my book, Blooming in the Mud. Those were the perfect fertile grounds in a way to kind of develop an independence and a strength in myself. So I look back now with gratitude, even though, wow, I'm glad those days are gone. But I can see where I kind of forged a depth and an understanding and a realism, you know, about life through those experiences.
I was just going to say, I mean, I couldn't relate more on a completely different level or a different scenario, but I resonate immediately when you said you were very sensitive at a young age. I think in your book you'd mentioned, I think you were around five when you recognized for the first time this is going to be a tough life, or I don't mean to misquote you, but something to that verbatim. And that really stuck out to me because I was maybe a little like six, seven, eight, but I've always been very sensitive as well. And that ultimately led me down the path of drug and alcohol addiction. And I look back at those very near-death experiences I've had and that I also wouldn't wish upon anyone. But I see now how they led me to where I am today and to be, you know, in the position of service that I am and to be able to give back. And very much, you know, that, again, two different scenarios, but pain is pain and suffering is suffering. And then to take that and use that as a fuel to inspire yourself to go inward on your own healing journey so that you can share that with others, I think is commendable. And I appreciate that, you know, you do share very candidly in the book about growing up and in that environment and the effect it had on you. And the one thing I don't recall was, I'm sure you were there during, or I believe you were there during the Rodney King verdict. What was your experience? Because, you know, here we are, I am from the East Coast and, you know, we're watching this just travesty of justice happen. And, where were you and what was that like for you? I know you spoke to just seeing the suffering around, but that's something I think any listener is familiar with and can relate to. What was your experience of that event, and where were you on your path towards any sort of mindfulness or meditation, or was it just another thing that added to you, you know, journeying in that direction?
Yeah, I think at that time I was around 17 or 18, so not very old. And I was a few miles away from the epicenter of that whole, you know, like where it sparked out in South Central. But I knew the area well. So it was interesting to see, you know, Florence and Normandy, these neighborhoods that I was very familiar with. But I was a couple of miles away, closer to the ocean. But again, you know, it was, I wasn't surprised because it was, the whole area was just like, there's this trigger point that you felt like it was something was heading towards something. You know, there was so much violence, so much pain. It was like, how is this going to, explode? And I wasn't really that surprised, but the whole incident, I think, for the country was just another wake-up call.
Yeah.
I mean, that was like another turning point, right? It was another moment in time. And we've been having these moments in time similar to that, just different shootings. And so the whole thing just really brings up, violence, racism, and the grind of urban poverty, and the emotions in communities around injustice. So there's similarities, whether it's the Black Lives Matter movement or there's similar feelings that, this stuff is coming around again. It's been coming around again. So it's just, again, holding that complexity.
Yeah, very well said. It, obviously with, not to get political, but with the elections in 2017 and, or was it 20, whenever it was, whenever 45 took office, it's still surreal to me, but to see that it was still there, it was just, I don't know if dormant it is exactly the right word, but to know that these things were still under the wood or under the rocks, so to speak, yet now the floodgates have opened up again, and here we are finding ourselves in this very tumultuous time. Like I said earlier, it's quite a time to be in a role such as yourself, where you're out there trying to help others heal and make peace, start within and work without. So, moving on to your actual engaging and interest in mindfulness and meditation. I know you talk about in the book, you share a story about the first retreat you went on. You were the only person of color and the youngest by 3 decades. I relate in the sense, not color-wise, because I'm Caucasian, but I'm tattooed like head to toe, basically. Most of the people when I first started about 20 years ago were similarly decades older than I was. Ram Dass was a root teacher for me and others. Mm. But so if you could share a bit about leading up to that retreat, if you can talk about where was the turning point that you knew, like, I want to explore this, what was your gateway into the mindfulness and meditation? And then what led you to that retreat?
Yeah, I think for all of us, this path of where we start in our community is really interesting how we, how we begin.
Yeah.
So as a teenager, I got really interested in psychology, trying to diagnose myself.
Sure.
So I had been very interested in that. I started going to a church in Los Angeles called Agape.
Yep.
Where I was learning with Reverend Michael Beckwith about meditation and about the mind.
Yeah.
Because I did have this sense very early on, even at 5 years old, there's something with the mind here. And I kept thinking, I know I have a thinking problem. I know it. I know there is the outside, but there's also this mind thing, and there's a way that the thought processes. So I really was interested. And so I got interested in meditation, and I started off studying at Self-Realization Fellowship, Paramahansa Yogananda, who wrote Autobiography of a Yogi. So many people have either, were introduced to some aspect of their path, maybe through that book or his writings and teachings. But when I would go to that community, they never gave me any meditation instruction. And so I was lost. I'd be just sitting there for hours and they'd say, just love God. I'd be like, well, I'm trying, but my mind is, psychotic right now. I can't do this, right? I'm not feeling it. Maybe after 3 hours, I'd feel a little more peaceful. But I started to feel like I wasn't getting anywhere. Like, sure. I don't know if this is meditation.
Right.
So I was really lucky. I heard about a 10-day retreat in the desert in Yucca Valley in Southern California. I heard about a 10-day retreat, and I didn't know who led it, but somebody said, oh, they teach you how to meditate, and it's vegetarian food, and you're in silence. And I was like, I know if I get to that retreat, everything will make sense. I need someone to help me with my mind. And of course, you know, when you're on the in a moment of a catalyst, the bottom usually falls out. And so everything leading up to the retreat, I was fired. My partner and I fell apart. My car was about to get repossessed. I was in East Oakland at the time. And I somehow managed to get to that retreat. And sure enough, everything made sense. And I didn't even know that Jack Kornfield was leading the retreat. I didn't know who he was. I didn't even know about Buddhism. I didn't, you know, at that point, I was heavily identified with more of the Hindu tradition, with mystic tradition, New Thought Church. But it was during that 10 days that I felt like, oh my gosh, now I have a path. And it just clicked for me. And I loved the Dharma immediately. And I knew that this was a part of my future. This was it. And I just sort of jumped in wholeheartedly. And I was in my early to maybe mid 20s at that time.
Yep. I think that's so great. I've had the, you know, very good fortune of speaking at a few conferences with Dr. Beckwith, and as actually just did out in Phoenix and did one with him in July. And what a lovely, lovely gentleman he is. Really enjoy him. And I too, I've never been to the self-realization actual facility, but I was a student for a while. I even signed up for those the lessons
the
in Kriya
classes,
yoga.
Yeah,
so I would get them in the mail, and similar, like I did everything, and I was like, I don't understand. Like I wasn't feeling that change, and still, like I draw from all of, I think, the mystic elements of the great wisdom traditions. I find a real beautiful similarity, and say something that Meister Eckhart might say from the Christian tradition to something Thich Nhat Hanh could say, you know, and to me, it's so interesting. It's like, wow, I'm reading a mystic Christian text, but it's essentially talking about emptiness from a Buddhist perspective, if I were to look at it like that. And I love that crossover. So anyways, you get to this retreat and Jack's leading it, who obviously you now know is, you know, a very in the spirituality world, a very famous teacher and very well known and renowned and respected. He's had a very deep impact personally in my path. And so, but as you mentioned, you know, you're the only person of color there. You're so much younger than everyone else. But then you just shared, you know, like immediately I knew like the Dharma, it clicked. So was there like, did you feel any kind of hurdle you needed to get over in regards to your physical, you know, your body, you know, your humanness there? Or did it just like wash away once Jack started teaching and the meditation started to take place?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think at the time I noticed the community didn't really reflect my colorful world. Yes. You know, I saw that right away. But at the time, I was so desperate. You know, I was like in spiritual ambulance. Yeah. You know, I almost collapsed, you know, on the table when I was registering. Like, I need help. Like, I don't know what's going on, right? And so they were like, okay, we gotcha. And so at the time, I didn't notice as much of the external. I mean, I noticed, but it didn't bother me. I was so internal. I was just absorbing the teaching so deeply and practicing. And I was really lucky. I magically wound up on Jack's interview list by accident. Nobody knows how that happened, but of course, you know, there's always a greater, there's a greater mystery.
Yes.
Always.
Yes.
So then after that became more of a challenge, because I really committed to this is my life. And I started going on years of long retreats. I immediately signed up for retreat and then other 10-day retreats. And I really committed. And it was within a couple of years that I thought, you know, because I'm the only person, my faith started to wane. Like, I don't know if I can keep going with this community, which I know that nobody was doing anything to me. It wasn't that I felt there was racism or ageism directed at me. It was that I didn't see myself reflected anywhere. And then that began to kind of take a toll on my heart in a really powerful way. Suffering began to arise there.
Right. And so what did you do with that when that experience of suffering began to arise? And we are going to get to your book. I think this is all segueing into it. But so what did you, and this is also shared in the book too, but you know, how did you meet that? Because at this point, you're not at the point you are now where you're a teacher, you know, you're still newer and learning. How were you able to work your way through that?
Well, I think a few reasons or a few things kind of led to a motivation to create a community.
Yeah.
And so what I started to think about was that at that time I had moved to Oakland, closer to Spirit Rock.
Yeah.
I got enrolled in one of their 2-year training programs,
yeah,
the Community Dharma Leader Training Program. And it was before that training that I said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to create a community in Oakland where I live.
Yeah.
And that motivation became such a powerful force inside. And that was really to help heal myself. Like, I want a community that reflects this urban landscape, you know, diverse people, LGBTQ, the tattoo community,
yeah,
the transgender community, the, you know, all beings in a way. And so young people, every age. And so I was really excited about that. So the suffering motivated me to do an act of compassion, which is to help create a community that I felt that I could be so happy to be a part of. Like, you know, I was happy to be a part of the other community in which I initially trained. Spirit Rock has been my home for years. I'm on the teachers council there.
Yeah.
But there was a call to create something new.
Yeah.
And so that was my response, was to be a part of building this new community, which fueled my love, and it kept me going with the Dharma, you know?
Yeah. And I love that. And so we're talking about, for listeners, the center you created, that's called East Bay Meditation Center, which is, like you said, can we get one going here in the East Coast too? Because, you know, like, I do a lot of work with teens. A lot of it's based at a residential program here, a mental health residential program in Connecticut. And I know that there were meetings. I don't want to name names, but there was someone else that was or is still a Buddhist teacher. Truth be told, an early inspiration for me, because I saw someone that looked like myself and I was struggling. I was early on in the path. And while I'm reading Ram Dass and I'm reading Jack and I'm reading, you know, the other books from different traditions, I was having a hard time finding my place, fitting in. And then I came across this work, and that was great. It was helpful. And it was like, okay, I'm not alone. And I would meet other, you know, younger people that were into punk rock and hip hop and, you know, just other out of the box things. And, you know, other, like you said, the LGBTQ community. And it was just very inviting and welcoming and felt more natural to me. And unfortunately, some of that is dissolved. And, you know, we're always in need of more facilities. So I deeply commend you for creating that, along with, like I said, the work that you're doing. And so, can you talk a little bit, I guess, about the center? You know, you talked about the motivation, but if you don't mind sharing about the center and how it's grown, and essentially, I think you kind of shared the mission, but if there's anything further, I would love to our listeners to learn more about that.
Yeah, I mean, the center really has evolved. I mean, it was me and a group of people that got really inspired.
Yeah.
A lot of us that started it came out of the Community Dharma Leader Training, and we wanted something really accessible. It was really an experiment at
yeah.
first. It was like, can we create an urban community based on all generosity economics,
yeah.
right? No charges,
yeah.
nothing, really quality Dharma teaching. And anybody could just come in. And it's amazing, you know, almost 14 years later, East Bay Meditation Center is really thriving. There's so many programs, teens, youth, people of color, LGBT, activists. I mean, everything is really happening there. And so it's kind of evolving. So if you're in Oakland, yeah, definitely drop by. There's programs going on all the time. It's just something to see, and to be a part of, and just feel what a different kind of sangha can be like when it's very intentional and inclusive. It's just, you know, it was a labor of love. And, you know, we have a whole new group of teachers involved. And now I'm kind of like the grandmother in a funny way, you know, as I've stepped a little more out, just working on other projects. But that's also part of it. Like the torch is handed down, you know, and new teachers are coming up, new voices. And, you know, so I'm still very connected to it, but not teaching as much there as I used to, just because I moved to Southern California.
Right.
But it's just founded on this idea that what if we opened up something for people, all beings, and we tried to be really accommodating to that, disabled communities, non-English speaking communities. And it was a grand experiment, and it wasn't easy. At times it was really hard. I will say it challenged my heart in a certain way, you know, and it forced me to expand. And that's what we want. We want to see our biases. We want to expand. We want to not be attached to certain things. But it was beautiful and challenging at times. And I learned so much. And I dedicated the book to that community because, wow, 10 years of work there, I honed a fierce heart.
Exactly. And speaking of which, thank you for saying that, because my next question was going to be jumping into the book, A Fierce Heart, you know, and the subtitle is Finding Strength, Courage, and Wisdom in Any Moment. So I think you already started to answer this, but, you know, why name the book A Fierce Heart?
Yeah, you know, I think it has some things to do with how I grew up and how we meet challenges and how we look at difficulties. You know, I collect biographies and I write about this biography collection that I have of seeing how we can use difficulties to grow.
Right.
You know, how you used all your experiences growing up, right? And your addiction and overcoming it. And don't we just love those stories?
Right.
I mean, I love an underdog, you know,
yes,
like
same.
Everything thrown at you and you persevere.
Right.
And not only persevere, you grow and thrive and help others. I mean, that's just the best. That's the hero.
Right.
And or the heroine. And so I just love that. And so over time, what I would do is in Oakland, I heard so many stories all the time. I listened to so many stories. I looked into people's faces and I, you know, as I hug them and work with them, and we're in evening classes and day longs and I'm meeting with people one-on-one, I'm hearing all these stories of people overcoming. And the fierce heart is just a heart that can hold, the beauty of life, but also the heartbreak.
Right.
Which many of us experience. This is not just unicorns and, you know, all the time. It's great when that is the case.
Yeah.
But what about when it's really challenging and there's injustice and people being shot and police violence and death and illness? So the fierce heart is like the heart that can hold it all and stay really strong.
I absolutely love that. And I appreciate you also sharing that. It isn't all unicorn and rainbows. You know, a lot of people, when they step onto the path or start a meditation practice, have this, you know, misunderstanding that, all right, I'm going to do this and everything's going to be great and blissful. And I mean, I can't speak for anyone but myself, but I've certainly had those absolutely wonderful, transparent experiences and not transparent, I'm sorry. Transcendental, which are lovely, but I've also had those like, wow, you know, like I'm in a nightmare. These things are coming up that, you know, that meditation's opening those floodgates of just stuff I've repressed and suppressed. And so it's, you know, it's beautiful and terrifying and but in a very fulfilling and embodying sort of manner. So I appreciate that you share that, because I always try to tell people when they're new, it's like, that's wonderful, and not in a scare you off sort of way, but just make sure you're prepared. You know, this, if you're going to take a step, you know, it's not an easy path. I think it was Trungpa Rinpoche, who said it's better to not start at all, but if you do start, you have to go all the way, something to that effect. And yes, at times I wish I had taken his advice and not started at all. But, you know, that's only, I say that half jokingly because I wouldn't have it any other way. I'm very grateful. So you talk about like the subtitle, Finding Strength, Courage, and Wisdom in Any Moment. You know, not only what I love is in this book, you do share about your own journey. You share about things you've taken away. You share others' stories, lots of just beautiful quotes and inspirations. Is there a, speaking of like finding strength, courage, and wisdom in any moment, is there something, say someone's listening and they've been on the fence about stepping onto the quote unquote path of mindfulness and meditation? Is there like a very beginner's practice, or not even a practice, or, you know, something simple that you, that someone listening right now that could begin doing today to find that strength, courage, and wisdom within themselves, literally in any moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think for a lot of us, it's just the practices are just beginning to become aware. You know, we start to start to hit the pause button a little bit more, like, and just self-inquiry, like, where, what are my intentions? What do I want to create in the world? You know, just the, it's like just the beginning process of what am I doing every day? And am I happy, you know? Because I think as we begin to learn about ourselves, our unhappiness becomes one of the heavenly messengers, you know, when things aren't working, you know, that that's the beginning of a wake up call. And I think just beginning to do just some general inquiry, or maybe going on a really short retreat, even a weekend, can be really powerful for people. Just the act of stopping. And it's a good time, you know, for these kind of reflections. We're coming out of, you know, coming into the new year. That's always a time where people get very inspired, right? It's like, okay, 2020, let's create change. Let's do it differently. So this is a really beautiful time to begin to reflect on how you want to use your life force. What do you want to do with your time here? Very valuable time.
It is. And that's great. And I pretty much offer very similar, you know, like start easy, start gentle. Start with something that you can commit yourself to, hopefully on a daily basis. You know, if you miss a day, don't throw in the towel. Stick with it. It's like, you know, like you mentioned, the new year coming up. I go to the gym and I see, you know, the rise in January, and then the trickle that begins towards the end of January. Exactly. Because we want that instant gratification, and everything takes time. You know, that's worth it. It really generally takes time. So, you know, something that you talk about in the book that I have struggled with myself, and I'm glad you addressed this, because I'd mentioned a bit about the fear, and it's not all unicorns and rainbows, or you'd mentioned that, and my following up on that is how it can be so difficult for us to work with our emotions and our traumatic experiences, and, you know, they're very uncomfortable and can be very frightening. And as I mentioned about myself, you know, I'm certainly, I've nearly died from my own addiction experiences, which I now understand were simply the fact that I was not willing to start to lay my own heart armor aside and get raw and vulnerable with those uncomfortable places. Because I would be sober for a year or 2 years or 5 years, you know, get all this time. But it wasn't until I truly laid that down and was willing to go to those places. And for me, a very helpful, probably, I mean, just as much as meditation in my own journey has been trauma-based therapy, such as EMDR or ART. They've been so beneficial. But that's just me. Aside from that, I know you address this in the book, and I would love to hear your perspective and what you would say to, for example, younger Chris, you know, who's like scared. He knows those places are there, but it's just, it's so frightening to actually shine a light in and take a look. What would you say to to somebody, you know, that is in that position. And to be clear, I'll be honest, I still get in that position to this day. There are still, you know, my healing journey, I know will be a lifelong one. I can heal, you know, it's just the more therapy and trauma-based therapy I do, I find more things, or it's life. So more things happen and we have life experiences. So I just want to be clear. I'm not saying I am any kind of healed, you know, totally integrated individual. But I can say that it's so worth the discomfort and working with it. So anyways, that was just a side tangent. I would love to hear though what you would share.
Yeah, I mean, I so admire anyone who is willing to work through the darkness, you know, and experience the dark night or go through what they need to do to let go of these energies, especially trauma, which I too, you know, I feel like it is so scary sometimes for me too. You know, I have the strength to meet it, but when I feel like, uh-oh, there's a big tangle, it's like, it's coming up again. And, you know, you think, wait, didn't I already deal with this? And then again, there's like residue, you know, in the system as we're moving more and more and more toward the heart-based energy, there are these big tangles, you know, from our family tree and incidences that have happened, and we can work them out on the mental level, you know, say we go to therapy and we sort it, but those energies are still in, you know, the physical body, the emotional body, and even the vibrational body, you know, and we have to kind of be willing to go deeper and deeper. I think for a lot of people, you know, having worked with so many people with trauma in Oakland and even on the shamanic side of the work that I do in South America, that's all about trauma and releasing these energies. Yeah. I think it's really important to just get a lot of support. So I really like what you're doing with the somatic-based therapy approach. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's a training ground in some way on how to be with these experiences as energy.
Yeah.
And we really do have to have compassion here. That's no joke. Without the tenderness, it's almost impossible to do any real healing work. One has to have a kind of loving approach to working with this on an energetic level. It's pain. And so training in compassion, self-compassion first, I feel like could be a beautiful step for someone who's like, I'm in the thick of it. Yes. You know, I don't see any way out. Okay, the way in is going to be through the Brahma Viharas, love, compassion. Like, we got to build that as the foundation first and foremost. And that's less scary as an entry point.
So well said. And loving kindness, the meditative practice has been one of the most transformative, I mean, to the point where I have it tattooed on my hands, like, just I can never not forget, you know, thanks to Sharon Salzberg's work. I know a lot of teachers teach it, but hers specifically, and it was a trip, like, I think 4 years ago, she shared an article and she used a picture of my hands, and I was like, oh, well, that's cool. Like, it was very endearing for me because she's been, you know, such a tremendous teacher for me. I really appreciate what you said, and that too is something I've struggled with, and the compassion component. I remember when I was seeing a therapist a few years ago, prior to starting with the trauma-based therapy, he made a really good point to me, because I do, and I still will struggle with self-compassion at times, hence that reminder right on my hands. But he said, as counterintuitive as this sounds, when he was talking to me about the, you know, the ways in which I would go back to self-destructive behavior, like relapsing or whatever other behaviors, you know, I knew weren't self-serving. He really helped shine a light on that for me, in the sense that, again, saying this will sound counterintuitive, but those were actually, in a way, your unconscious, the unconscious Chris being compassionate towards himself, because you did not know any other way to relieve this amount of pain that you were suffering through. Yet you knew from past experience that picking up that bottle or that drug, even though it was very temporary, would release that pain. And he made it clear, I'm not saying that, you know, now go do that again, but he's saying when you find yourself beating yourself up over those things, that was your neural pathways. That was your brain. And that for me really just helped a lot when it came to cultivating more compassion. And so I share that just for any listeners, you know, replace drugs and alcohol with whatever it is in your life. And I hope that's of benefit, because that helps me to this day. I have to remind myself of these conditioned patterns that we have. It's something I'm sure you know, and you write about what you know all too well. And another way of getting in touch with said, you know, unconscious and other patterns, and something that can be controversial, especially within the Buddhist community, also in the recovery community, is working with plant-based medicines and from a shamanic perspective. So, you know, that's something I know that you write about in the book, and I would love to hear you talk a bit about that and your experience with that, and the benefits that you've both personally experienced and seen others as a result.
Yeah, and I do want to say that I'm very sensitive to the recovery community, and I understand that this topic can be confusing, even terrifying. Like, where are we going with this?
Right, you know,
and I've always just met that head on, the fifth precept, and said, yes, I know it is. It is confusing. It is. You know, maybe even shocking or scary to someone who's in recovery and kind of has found the Dharma to be such a powerful refuge.
Right.
And so I just really, really want to honor that complexity in that perspective, and yet still talk about it in terms of healing, because that's what it is: medicine, healing, transformation.
Right.
And yeah, my work in Peru came out of me trying to heal my own trauma. That's really all it was about. I was on a 3-month course with Joseph Goldstein, my lead teacher, doing concentration practice of all things,
right.
You know, working with the heart, doing a heart-based concentration practice.
Yeah.
And then all of this old material came up. And then, you know, as a community of teachers, too, within the Insight tradition, we are learning about trauma as we go. What we know now and what we knew 10 years ago, light years.
Right. Absolutely.
I mean, this is like, you know, like evolution. And my sort of meltdown or breakdown on the 3-month retreat in Massachusetts was 12 years ago. And nobody knew what was happening, really, you know, and I was in teacher training at that time. So I thought, oh, my God, I need to have all the answers. What's going on? We had opened our community. I was supposed to be over that, you know, not falling down the rabbit hole. But that's always funny, because, you know, when we think we've reached something is when the bottom falls out.
Sure.
You know, once you climb the mountain, you fall down, and then there's a higher one right in front of you. You know,
that's
the spiritual journey. You know, there's no arrival.
Right.
It's just, you know, one hill after the next, you know, so it's like, okay, I thought I had reached the, you know, some kind of, it was great. So that's what happened, really. I left a retreat like a week early in a state of complete disassociation. I didn't know it then, like I understand now.
Yeah.
When you really disassociate, you go into a panic, you have anxiety, you know, it's a terrible feeling when you're not in your body and you're gone.
Right.
And you don't know how to sort of reconnect there. So I just ran into a psychologist friend of mine, you know, when I went back to California and explained everything that was happening. And what was interesting was the Dharma, the fact of the container of a silent, intense retreat, we know now isn't helpful for trauma.
Right.
That you need contact, actually. And so we learned, right? So we used to tell people, just go sit in the hall. You'll be fine. You know, just be with it. Oh, no, there's some things that you can't, you know, you actually do need that contact. You need that help. So that's what led me to working with plant medicine and ayahuasca in particular. I was introduced to it by a group of psychologists And she said, you know, a friend of mine who was a clinical psychologist and had overcome all her own trauma in her family of origin said, you know, I've been working with this plant. And I was like, what? But I was so desperate. You know, I was willing to do anything, swim with dolphins, go to Nepal. You know, I was like, help, you know, like universe. I hit the alarm button, you know, like something's going on and I can't be with it. Somehow my practices aren't able to help me be in my body in a way. I'm in territory I've never been before. So that led me to working with it. And then I found enormous benefit from it, from kind of moving through these karmic knots. And I started going to Peru and working with indigenous healers. I really wanted to understand the origin of the plants. And I look at it almost like Ayurvedic medicine or Chinese medicine, but it's Amazonian medicine, plant consciousness medicine. So, and then here I am 12 years later, and I lead retreats that are Buddhist based. And yeah, we do Dharma, and then we have these ceremonies.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful. One of the things I've always loved about Buddhism is, you know, the churning of the wheels and even the Dalai Lama saying, you know, if science ever, you know, shows something or proves something that Buddhism teaches incorrect, you know, we must go with that. And it's not like set in stone. And that's, it's a very fluid moving thing. And I love that. And then, you know, I look at recovery, like the 12 step traditions, and I owe a lot to them. I'm not an active member, but I certainly owe a lot. But one thing that they neglected was trauma. They didn't really, they addressed a lot, and they have saved countless lives. So I have complete respect for them. But, you know, I just wasn't finding the trauma component I needed there. And the other interesting thing I found out several years ago was one of the co-creators, Bill W. of AA, actually was a proponent for not ayahuasca at this point, but psychedelics, and saying that there was the potential for great healing for certain individuals. And he also talked about the practice and teachings of Buddhism. And I've seen the pamphlets. They were written back in the 40s. But after his death, they were quickly swept under the rug. So, you know, if you do enough digging, you can find them online and they're there. But it's something now, you know, both. And that's what I find interesting is in Buddhist circles and recovery circles, you have the fifth precept in Buddhism. And, you know, there's plenty of like staunch teachers that say, you know, no, it's, you know, even a plant medicine. I use that word specifically because I am absolutely pro plant medicine. If it is beneficial to those that are healing, who am I to say anything else? It's their journey, not mine. And same in the recovery community, like anything that alters your mind, you know, they say is not good for you. It's a drug. But yet again, I see people drinking four or five cups of coffee and, you know, eating 15 cookies and I recognize, you know, recovery speaking, it's an obsessive compulsive mental disorder. And that's why I even dropped saying I'm in recovery, because I, even though I haven't touched a drug or a drink in a long time, I will still catch myself sometimes acting out with food in the same way, for example, you know, as I would with drugs. So the drugs and the alcohol, they're just like symptoms of the actual issue that I personally live with. So, you know, another side tangent, but I think that I honor that you do that work. I think it's incredible. I've had the fortune of speaking with Gabor Mate several times, who... Yes, he's really, you know, I've watched so much, so many of his YouTube videos, aside from reading his book, and just, you know, speaking about plant medicine and the healing properties that they have. And he says they're not for everyone. He makes that very clear. But they are for some people. And those, I can tell you, those I know that have taken them... have had very transformative life experiences. So I'm glad that you are, you know, doing what you're doing and, you know, honoring your truth and your teaching modalities. I think that's incredible. So for those that are struggling with trauma, yet, you know, don't feel called to the plant medicines, whether it's out of fear or they just, you know, intuitively, internally don't feel called. Do you still feel that they can find the necessary healing they're looking for elsewhere, like through meditative practices and just trauma-based therapies and things of that nature?
Oh, yes. I think there's tremendous value. I mean, I feel like I did heal a lot with all the meditation practices that I had done and still do. I feel like it's an enormous benefit. I mean, I can't live my life sanely without meditation and yoga. And I don't know how people do it. Honestly, I'll just get so lost and, you know. So I heavily rely on my daily Dharma dose of everything, all things Dharma. So it hasn't replaced that. If anything, my work with the plants have deepened my devotion to living in the present moment, living ethically. So, and also working on trauma through the body, my yogic practice has become a whole nother way of learning embodiment.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing about the Dharma is we keep evolving into it. Yeah. Like I'm still learning about the present moment. I'm still understanding things.
Right.
So yes, you can do a lot of good. Plant-based medicine is one approach.
Right.
But you can do a lot with all these practices. Retreats are incredibly healing and profound and helpful for trauma. And so really trust your heart. You know what is going to work for you. And if plant-based medicine feels aligned and you have a deep calling and you're physically able and it's the right moment, great. If you know, or finding these other retreats that are focused on, you know, maybe that you need to work with women's retreat or a men's retreat, or there's also so many beautiful things coming online that can help you work with your trauma, or maybe just a retreat for LGBTQ. That can be very healing for someone to treat like that, a affinity-based retreat. So I love all of the options that we have, and I utilize them all, you know, very much.
Yeah, and I think that's wonderful. I appreciate you sharing that. I think it's like I tell people when I teach or I do my own workshops, you know, they might ask, which fellowship do you recommend or which spiritual path? And, you know, very similar. What I recommend is what works for you. What feels right to you. You know, like, yes, take the guidance of those who've walked the path and left the light on for us. But you, at the end of the day, you're the only one who's going to know what that path truly is for you. And it might not just be one path for your whole life. You know, like you said, you had started it kind of vice versa to Ram Dass, where you started more rooted in the Hindu tradition and moved to Buddhism, where Ram Dass started more in Buddhist and, you know, moved to Hindu. And I love watching him and Sharon sometimes in fun, you know, like they'll kind of bicker a little bit back and forth about soul, no soul, and you know, things of that nature. But it's always in good fun. And but at the end of the day, you know, they too will honor, like Ram Dass says, the spiritual path is highly individualized. It's not true that you should follow just one path or, you know, one teaching specifically that's, you know, taught to you from the time of birth or whatever the case. And the one, before I ask you the final question, you did mention working with trauma in your body. And I did want to recommend to readers a wonderful book by a gentleman named Bessel van der Kolk called The Body Keeps the Score, which is a fantastic read about traumas and how our bodies hold them and ways in which to work with them. It's also on, of course, audiobook if you're not a reader. I can't recommend that strongly enough. Of course, read Spring's book first, A Fierce Heart, but then when you're done with that, Bessel van der Kolk's is a wonderful book to move on to. But so Spring, I know I said earlier that I didn't want to get, you know, too political in this conversation, but it, you know, here we are, the impeachments were just announced. it's kind of hard not to. You know, I was watching the news earlier and, you know, just a quick catch up. All you really need is 10 minutes and you've got like the day's, you know, highlights. But the reason I mention that is, you know, in A Fierce Heart, I feel like there's so much that we can learn and bring into our own lives that can help us during these difficult times to work with and be more compassionate towards those that don't necessarily see eye to eye with us, even if they aren't giving us the same reciprocal respect. And that's not saying lay down and you know, allow yourself to be taken advantage of or you know, bullied or anything of that nature, but helping, you know, to just take a more compassionate approach towards the situation as a whole and individually when it arises. So, you know, how can cultivating the fierce heart, which we've talked about, help us work with these political times that we're currently living in and those that are, you know, that don't see eye to eye to us? Because personally, you know, I have family that, you know, is on the other side. And
right. You know, I gotcha. Just,
yeah, we agree not to talk about it and leave it at that. But that's not always the healthiest thing. So anyways, yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
I mean, it's such a, this topic is so up, right? Thanksgiving dinner tables and, you know, it has divided families.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, even relationships, you know, where you have two people married on very different sides of the belief spectrum. And you know, it's really astonishing the times that we're living in. Yeah. I mean, you know, impeachment and it's probably going to get really bad now. I mean, we thought it was, we thought it was hard before, you know, we're coming up to elections and the year out or, you know, it's just going to probably be a political bloodbath.
Yes.
So that being said, wow, you know, we're witnessing, we learn, you know, and a big part of my work is like all life is school and everything is our teacher.
Yeah.
Like, how is this, you know, we're going to witness a battle between people, a battle for ideas, a battle for the country and policy. And yeah, it's really challenging. And how do we work with that without getting caught up in the fray and the negativity and the fear? I think a lot of it is fear.
Yeah.
You know, and so I want to encourage people to be mindful of the stories of fear. Like, what does this all mean? You know, what's going to happen? Because we can start preparing for the end of days, you know, on an emotional level. But can we trust that all of these things are cycles, you know, and we're in an epic storm? You know, we came out of a beautiful 8-year cycle. Wasn't perfect, not at all. But for a lot of people, we kind of, it was the, you know, rainbows and
yeah,
you know, it's a fairy tale, you know, and so we all just coasted along on that. And you know, again, not perfect, it never is in samsara. This is samsara. It's inherently, you know, a system that's broken, and in that brokenness there's the perfection of, we can use these conditions to wake up. You know, so that's what I look at it like, wow, these are the perfect conditions for let's wake up here, you know?
I love that. Wonderful perspective. I couldn't agree more. Those were a wonderful 8 years that are dearly missed. Going back a little bit before those 8 years, I was joking with my fiance. I think it was like 2 nights ago. Did you ever think pre-Obama you would ever be living in an era where you would look back and say, gosh, I miss George W. Bush.
Yeah, exactly. He seems so beautiful and rational. I know.
I've had
a similar thought.
Yeah.
You know? But it's historic what we're witnessing.
It
will be in the books.
Yes. You know, something I've heard said, and I don't know where to credit it, is that chaos precipitates great change. And I hope, as long as we don't blow ourselves up first, you know, we live to see this beautiful change. And if anything, I think of my nieces and the children, truly, like, you know, the ones that are coming after us. You know, what kind of life, what kind of planet are we going to leave them with? And again, that's why the work you're doing, I bow deeply to that. And you know, the center that you created, and just everything your presence is bringing to this world and others like yourself, it's so needed. And so, at least from, you know, from me to you, I thank you sincerely for that. And I also want to let listeners know that, you know, I think this was a lovely conversation, and I appreciate your raw candidness and the fact that we just, you know, really organically went at it. and we definitely did address a lot of what's in Spring's book, but there is so much more. We barely scratched the surface. And so in the spirit of that, I did just want to briefly read on the back jacket. First of all, this book is available through Hay House, which means you can find it anywhere books are sold. And again, we'll have the link if you're on the Be Here Now website. But just to give an overview of the book quickly, In a Fierce Heart, Spring shares her contemporary unique interpretation of the Buddha's 2,500-year-old teachings that get to the heart of mindfulness, wisdom, and compassion. Woven throughout the book are stories from her life, family, and community, along with soulful and unexpected stories of compassion and action from all over the world. The life-saving teachings of this charismatic teacher are universal. Her honesty, enthusiasm, and energy are a balm. And I don't know who wrote that for you, but my hat is off to them because they nailed it. Truly.
That was Jack, actually.
Oh, that was from Jack's foreword?
I think so.
Oh, my gosh. That's beautiful then. Nice. Well done, Jack. Well done. So anyways, that book, or this book, A Fierce Heart, I can't recommend it enough. Again, it is available everywhere books are sold. Scroll down. You can click the link and both Spring's website as well as the one for her Lotus Vine Journeys will be there. Spring, anything that you wanted to leave our listeners with that we didn't cover in this conversation that you just wanted to get in there the last moment?
Yeah, I would just tell the listeners, you know, that again, this is the way of the heart, this whole path, and how can we stay connected to our love, our compassion, and to really take those practices on. I without those practices, I couldn't do anything. So you might want to switch to maybe working very intensively with a self-love practice, self-compassion practice in these times. And just remembering your community, like-minded friends on the path is everything. Yeah. So stay connected to your Sangha.
I love that. Absolutely. That's another big one I tell people. Never go it alone, no matter
what. Yes. Oh, my gosh.
So important. Well, I'm glad. What a perfect note to end on, Spring. Again, thank you for everything that you are doing in this world. And thank you for this book that I am sure has already helped countless people and will continue to do the same. So your time, greatly appreciated. And I can't wait for listeners to hear this.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.